So today, I'm going to be talking about doubt, faith, and courage. And one reason I kind of gravitated towards doubt is because doubt has always gravitated towards me. It's been something I've struggled with for a long time, particularly in my youth, which is maybe one reason why I had very few dates. I'm always doubting, you know, taking that courage to ask or something. But doubt plays also a big role, or is really recognized within the Buddhist tradition. And amongst one of the many, many numbered lists that we find in Buddhist writings, there's one called the Five Hindrances. And these are qualities that really hinder the full expression of our life and of our practice. So they not only prevent us from fully meeting life and the world, but these negative mental states really obscure our practice and really lead us towards frequently unwholesome actions. And certainly, we have all experienced how sensual desire, anger, laziness, restlessness, and doubt, those are the five hindrances, can overtake our minds just simply throughout the day. And we've all experienced, of course, how they can distract us in our meditation practice, right? A little bit of laziness, a little bit of doubt, desire, and off you go. Some fantasy or some memory. Sensual desire, anger, laziness, and restlessness, and doubt have enormous influence. And it's very difficult, I think, to kind of shake ourselves free or loose from their grasp, even when we acknowledge the kind of harmful influence that they can have on us. And sometimes, in fact, we can take kind of a headstrong pleasure in feeding them, right? Riding the waves of righteous anger or burning desire or sitting in placid vacancy like a couch potato, right? Watching TV or reading some trashy novel. Or, as I've experienced, dithering endlessly over whether to get the chocolate croissant or the cinnamon bun with cream cheese icing at J.J. Bean. Many years ago, in Japan, my Aikido teacher turned to me once when we were sitting at a restaurant and sipping some sake. And he asked me, who drinks whom? Do you drink the sake, or does the sake drink you? I think we need to ask the same question about the five hindrances. Do we dismantle them, or do we allow ourselves to be consumed by them? Each one of these hindrances challenges us. But doubt is one of the most pervasive and perhaps the most challenging because of our kind of collective tendency to keep, well, almost incessantly, questioning our life and our practice. Doubt is rather a colorless hindrance, unlike the garish hindrances of anger or sensual desire, for example, right? And yet, for all its seeming meekness or grayness, doubt is the great destroyer. And its close sibling is fear. Fear whispers of known and unknown dangers. Doubt then guides us away, guides us into avoidance and lassitude, of putting off for another day, which will in all likelihood never come. or taking us away from a rich, full life, placing that beyond our reach. So I think doubt is a great destroyer. And then certainly we're all familiar with the suffering that doubt can bring us, right? We've all been caught in its kind of tightening grip. Now, one Buddhist teacher describes it as the key infection of modern life. And certainly the advertising industry takes great advantage of this. Feeds on all kinds of doubts, right? Deepening our sense of powerlessness and uncertainty that can only be cured by fill in the blank. Doubt leaves us floundering in powerlessness and often feeling cut off from the world. With doubt, we lose the sense of who we are and how we should respond to the world around us. Doubt surely is one of our greatest sources of suffering, at times leaving us in really deep despair, and at other times manifesting more as a kind of non-specific anxiety or feeling a failure, not being up to the task. But I think in all cases, doubt sucks up energy, leaving us no heart to face our challenges. Now, doubt, of course, at least in English, has a positive aspect as well. A kind of inquiring form of doubt, right? We inquire. So I wish we had two different words in English for the form of doubt that guides us away from blindly accepting beliefs and ideas to explore through our own direct experience, which is true. Because that is a very important, of course, part of our practice. At the time of the Buddha, there was a group of townspeople known as the Kalamas. And they were really struggling to know what to believe, because many teachers had come into the village and offered them teachings, and none of these teachings seemed kind of contradictory to one another. And so they asked the Buddha, well, what's the truth? How are we going to know the truth? And the Buddha answered very clearly, and it's a quote here from the early texts. He said, when you yourselves know, these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed. These things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter in and abide in them. So the Buddha is saying, you should approach your practice with some doubt. You have to taste and test them with your own life. And in our Zen tradition, also greatly values doubt in that same way. We cultivate questioning, often using the phrase, for example, don't know mind, to remind ourselves to remain open to new possibilities and let go of our assumptions and our expectations. This form of doubt can give rise to clarity about what we don't know and can give us a kind of groundedness to remain upright with that. But that's not one of the hindrances. That kind of doubt is not one of the hindrances, right? But so let's talk about the kind of damaging doubt, what the Buddha is referring to here as the hindrances. Well, one kind of damaging doubt I think we see today in the media, and sometimes in ourselves, and that is what I would call disparagement or cynicism. And this kind of doubt really distances us from the world, from really seeing clearly. Standing at a distance, this doubt mockingly says, it's not worth even thinking about because it's so stupid. Often sparked by fear, we remove ourselves, and in doing so, we don't permit whatever it is to speak to us and reveal what it may have to offer. So under the label of this kind of sophistication or something like that, or maybe to avoid feeling foolish ourselves, we avoid even trying to understand and listen deeply. So this kind of doubt, and the other kind of doubt that I believe that the five hindrances refers to, well, this other one I think I'll call maybe, I'm trying to think of a good word for this, reactive doubt or hypothetical doubt, which often kind of manifests as self-doubt. And this form of doubt comes up regularly in our daily life and in our practice at times, conditioned perhaps by experiences of shame and failures. We reflexively doubt our own worth, our ability, our judgments. We doubt the truth of any compliments. And we can doubt our practice, right? How easily we brush aside compliments, right? Oh, no, no. It was nothing. You slaved all day to make the meal and get a compliment. Ah, nothing. This doubt is a form of questioning, where instead of using doubt to expand our understanding, we step aside. And often are frozen or disdainful. Self-doubt. The little voice inside saying, I can't do it. It couldn't work for me. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. Not courageous enough. Or I could never accomplish that. I'm too weak, too scattered, too broken. Instead of facing or admitting our vulnerability, our fear, we say something like, it's not worth doing, it's beyond me. And we take a very painful refuge in being too wounded or damaged. And with no heart to face our challenges, we easily then do other things like distract ourselves. Distract ourselves from anxiety using our wired culture or other ways. But as we all know, distraction is just a palliative, certainly not a cure. So when we're pulled into doubt, and I think especially self-doubt, it's very challenging to commit, to begin something, to follow through. We all know how we can be plagued with doubts, for example, in our relationships, our jobs, our life. And all sparked by perhaps past disappointments, times of failure, uncertainty, or an old story about yourself that you cling to. What a downer, eh? Doubt. So let's talk now about resiliency. I was thinking about how do we handle doubt? And I think, and there's probably many ways, but today I'd like to suggest two sources of resiliency that can help us face the suffering of doubt. And those are faith or trust and courage. I'm going to use faith and trust. I'm going to explain that a little bit, but maybe I'll start with courage. And I realize that my naming of these two sources of resiliency is somewhat arbitrarily, but I hope it will be somewhat helpful. So let's think about or talk about courage a little bit first. One way of thinking about courage is to assume it's a quality of mind that enables us to face difficulty, danger, pain, etc., despite our fear and anxiety. Sound somewhat close? And the word courage, as I think Kate mentioned on the weekend, comes from French, which, as I looked a little bit more, also comes from Latin, with the original meaning of heart. The meaning of heart. I was doing a little bit of reading research on this and discovered the sociologist and writer, I think Brené Brown, feels that the usual definition of courage fails to recognize the inner strength and resolve that the original word holds. And she offered this definition in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection. I haven't read this. This is just something I came across in a little article I was reading about her. But something about it struck me. She said, courage means to speak one's mind by telling all one's heart. By telling all one's heart. I think what she asks of us is to speak and act honestly and openly about who we are and what we have experienced, what our experience is. Telling all one's heart. The Austrian poet Rilke wrote, ultimately, it is on our vulnerability that we all depend. To speak one's heart is, of course, to be vulnerable. But that is the way we bring courage, I think, into our life and into this world. So the first courageous act is to meet one's doubt, to recognize the emotions and the body sensations, notice the negative and defeating language perhaps that arises. And this requires, of course, commitment and practice. Because as I said somewhere in the beginning of this talk, doubt is kind of a rather quiet and colorless hindrance. Sneaky. It's a sneaky hindrance. And so to see doubt with some clarity, though, is very helpful because it helps to chip away its solidity. Because doubt sometimes can feel so true, but it's not. And it opens a space to realize that you, I, we are not that doubt. It's just something that has been created by certain conditions, like disappointment, uncertainty, failure, old beliefs. The message of self-doubt is not the truth of who you are. It's just a mind state. Although at times, I must say, a pretty formidable mind state. But that's all it is. So doubt is something we all have, right? I think it's an unavoidable part of our life. It simply is there. The biographies and autobiographies of really strong men and women like Mother Teresa, Rosa Parks, Nelson Mandela, and even the Dalai Lama all mention periods of great doubt in their life. So doubt needs to be accepted just as part of life. It's part of the human condition. And if we can do that, then we can let go of the self-judgment that may arise, like somehow we shouldn't have doubt. We should be strong, you know, not weak. And the other strange thing is when we kind of become intimate with our doubt and we look at our experience of doubt, we may come to see that our doubts and anxieties don't often bear out. Right? Michel de Montaigne, one of the great French philosophers of the French Renaissance, once said, "My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened." And then I read this is also attributed to Mark Twain. And maybe he got it from, you know, reading French philosophers. But isn't that interesting? My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which have never happened. Well, I can vouch for that. Because Kate can
verify.
I'm one of those people who worry about everything. I'm not quite as bad as some, I probably, but I'm pretty good at it, right? The great disasters that never happened. So we become intimate with our doubt. We look at it. And I think the second courageous act is to really question our doubt. To doubt doubt, so to speak. It may help to label it, saying, "Oh, this is doubt. I see you." And then you can maybe ask, well, whose voice is this doubting voice? Right? Whose voice is this doubting voice? And these can give us a bit of a distance from that kind of entanglement that we experience with doubt. And with that distance, then we can really question the truth of what this doubt is telling us. Is this true? Is it to be believed? What would my life be like if I didn't believe this? So those are two ways, I think, that we can bring forth a bit of resiliency in our life around doubt. But the other resiliency that I want to spend a little bit of time on is faith or trust. Seems a little bit unusual to use the word faith in a Buddhist context. Right? Always think about it in a Christian context or the Judeo-Christian or Islamic tradition. But in the traditional Buddhist teachings, faith is noted as the antidote to doubt. So then we need to question, what does it mean, faith, in a Buddhist context? And in Pali, the word is sadha, sadha. And the word sadha includes the qualities of trust, clarity, and confidence. The other thing that's interesting is sadha literally means to place the heart upon. So to give our hearts over or to place our hearts on something. Very close to courage. The Vipassana teacher, Sharon Salzberg, wrote in her book called Faith, Trusting Our Own Deepest Experience. She wrote of two forms of faith in the Buddhist context. One she calls bright faith. And bright faith she described as the kind of intoxicating rush that we experience when we open to a sense of new possibility after we've been kind of locked in a place of confinement or felt something was really lacking in our life. So, the practice, the teachings, when we first encounter them, can seem very bright and shining to us, right? Or maybe even like a new relationship, right? Nothing like a new relationship, bright and shiny. Or a new job that we begin, we kind of have this experience of it being almost luminous. And we may meet someone or see something that inspires us. And this feeling of inspiration fills our hearts and minds with a warmth and brightness that we don't really, I think, fully understand, or at least we can't put it into words. But this form of faith, or this brightness, is only the beginning stage, according to Sharon Salzberg, even though it's very compelling. This faith must move into, if it is to be nurtured and to survive, move into what Sharon Salzberg calls verified faith. And verified faith is much closer to trust, because it rests largely on our own experience of life and truth. It's like the kind of faith or trust that we have in our doctor. She has a diploma on her wall, lots of people in her waiting room. We've heard positive things about her, right? But it's our experience with her, how she helped in the past, healed us from an affliction, that truly verifies and establishes our trust in her as our doctor. This is the kind of faith, verified faith, that Buddhism emphasizes. So faith in the Buddhist tradition is not faith in something outside of yourself, but a faith in reality and in your ability and your capacity to embrace it. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk and writer, great thinker, he presented a kind of complex and a very powerful definition of faith. And this is what he wrote. He said, faith, actually, I'll begin the quote, not simply an intellectual assent to certain authoritative dogmatic propositions, but more than that, the commitment of our whole life, the commitment of our whole self and our whole life to the reality and presence of Christ in the world. Now, if we can hear behind the Christian language, I think Merton is saying here that faith is a giving up of oneself to a larger reality, or seeing through yourself to something greater. To see through yourself to something greater. So for Merton, faith is a verb rather than a noun. It's not something you have. It's something you enact. And I think this is how the Buddhist tradition understands it as well. Faith or trust gradually arises when we see beyond the story of our everyday self. And faith differs greatly in this way from belief, because belief is a kind of conceptual overlay that rather fixes our view of reality. Whereas faith, because it's a verb, I say, has the quality to gather our energy to pursue our aspirations, to help us bear our difficulties, and most importantly, open us to the unknown. So one other aspect of faith I'd like to bring forward is the practice of vows. Our practice of making vows. A vow is an expression of really what matters most to us. One Zen teacher uses the expression, the heart's deepest aspiration. At various points in our life, we're struck with a profound yearning to express our life deeply and fully in a certain way. And that becomes a vow. Vows are acts of imagination and acts of courage. And they are the center of the bodhisattva's life. In Japanese, there's the expression, Gosho no bonpu, gasho no basatsu. Do you want to hear that again? Gosho no bonpu, gasho no basatsu. It's kind of the definition of a bodhisattva. And Shohaku Okumura, in his book Living by Vow, translates it like this. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. So karma is another topic for somewhere down the road. But we can consider just for here, karma as kind of something like our delusions, pettiness, craving, frustrations, rage, envy, our own woundedness, our doubts. A life led by doubts or a life led by vow. That's how we could maybe translate it. When we are assailed by doubt, doubt of our abilities, our personality, our practice, we can then remember our vows and return to them. What are your vows? What is your heart's deepest aspiration? Have you given a voice yet? I think that's really important to do. Because in those dark times, when doubt arises, or when it gets really dark and black, when despair is there, vows will be a rope, a lifeline, bringing you back into the world, and help us remain upright. Because they tell us, remind us, what is most true and most central to our life. So let's practice a little bit together. Just how do we use faith, for example? How do we cultivate this faith as a resiliency for us? So you want to maybe just take a meditation posture, just get comfortable again. I'm just going to do a little bit of a quick guided meditation. Well, not guided, I'm going to ask you to contemplate a little bit. So just feeling a sense of ease in your body. Remembering sometimes faith really means trust. Is there some quality within yourself that you trust? Love? Awareness itself? find that place. That for now feels you can trust this and rest there for a few moments. How does it feel? Bringing forth a little bit of gratitude for that place of trust, whatever it is. You may notice it becomes a little deeper. The Buddhist understanding of faith also includes inspiration, what Sharon Salzberg called bright faith. Maybe some initial inspiration brought you to this practice, or to a deeper exploration of yourself. Can you recall a time when you felt inspired? Remember that time. Invoke that feeling for a few moments, and let's rest there. Another quality that the Buddhist understanding of faith includes is confidence, built on experience. So you may think of a time in your life when you faced a task that was rather daunting, but you had the quality of confidence, and so you persevered. If you can, think of a time in your life when this was very present for you. This allowed you to take a risk, to keep going. Okay, thank you everyone for indulging me and participating in that.